Imagine you're a chef. How will you run your kitchen if you have no idea what ingredients you're getting that day? Now, not because you're waiting for your favorite local farmer to come surprise you with that day's harvest, but because you have to get your ingredients on the black market. Because you're cooking in a place where the government can make things like onions or even salt just go missing in a hurry. That's a question that was on Anya von Bremzen's mind when she started writing a book about Cuba. Now, she's not from there, but she's not really a stranger to the place because Anya grew up in the Soviet Union and went to a school where she was taught Spanish and poems honoring Fidel Castro. It was part of the two countries' like international communist romance. And of course, she grew up with those infamous Soviet breadlines and food shortages, so she understands firsthand the special kind of inventiveness that those shortages can inspire in a cook. She's written a book about the paladares, the private restaurants of Cuba that are actually in people's homes where the conditions are precarious, but where the cooking is full of optimism and creativity. She sat down with our contributor, the New York Times columnist, Melissa Clark.
Anya, welcome.
So good to be here.
So, Anya, what is a paladar? And did I say that right?
Paladar.
Paladar. And what made you want to write a book on Cuban restaurants and Cuban cuisine?
Well, paladar is kind of a speakeasy, plural is paladares. And actually, there's a really interesting backstory there. Essentially, there are private restaurants in Cuba, in a country where everything essentially is state-run. So that's already really interesting. And the word comes from a Brazilian telenovela, which Cubans were watching like crazy in the 1990s, and that was during the periodo especial, there's another Spanish word for you, the special period, when the Soviet Union abandoned them, and it led to just a total economic collapse. And during the time where they were literally having sugared water for dinner, they're watching this sexy Brazilian telenovela about a girl who starts selling sandwiches at Copacabana Beach and makes it really, you know, it's a Cinderella kind of rags to riches, becomes hugely popular. And all the Cubans remember just salivating over this girl and her success. And here was an island where there was no food and no private enterprise. And then Castro, because the situation was just so grim, allowed some measure of private enterprise. And that also extended to private restaurants. So the first paladares, and they called them paladares after the Brazilian telenovela, which is very cute. And those first enterprises were, according to law, they were to be run out of people's homes. So they were already like speakeasies, no more than 12 seats, and two family members had to be employed.
Wow!
And basically, there was no food, so everyone improvised whatever they could get.
Now, you are Russian. You're living in New York. Now, what is the connection with you in Cuba other than the Soviet connection? Is there something else?
You know, it was actually one of this cosmic kind of kismet, you know, luck situations. I really, really wanted to go to Cuba, hearing that was changing, and I kind of wanted to catch the last socialist moment to see how that society was because, you know, growing up in Russia, my second language was Spanish. I went to Spanish speaking school. My mother just sent me there, and my first crush was on a Cuban boy. Raul Castro came to our school. It was like this model Soviet school for Spanish speakers. Every other week, Fidel would come and, you know, kiss Brezhnev, which was like, you know, this bushy-eyed Brezhnev, you know, bushy-bearded Fidel, you know, they're all locked in this, like, internal socialist embrace. And, you know, he would come for another handout from the USSR.
So what was that like to be there and to see the shortages again and to really, you know, be immersed in this culture that was similar to how you grew up? Or was it?
It kind of made me believe in time machines. It was an utterly, utterly surreal experience. Well, the first shock, literally, I screamed. It was so shocking. It was landing. We landed in a small town because it was they just inaugurated direct flights in Santa Clara. And I see all those American cars gliding by from the 50s. And I literally shrieked because it was like, you know, landing in Jurassic Park.
But,
you know, you've seen one car in the museum, another car, but actually, you know, because they're so huge.
Yeah.
And they have the sculpted things on them. So, and then I realized that the default car is not the, you know, the American Chevy from the 1956. It's the Soviet Lada.
Ah.
And suddenly I'm feeling like I'm back in the socialist moment of like 1989 when Russia was going through perestroika. Mm. So it was already open to the West. There was something trickling in from the West. There was this double economy where you could actually operate with dollars. So it was Soviet Union back in a very specific moment. And what was really incredible was not just that there was so much Soviet aid economically to Cuba, but that there, the whole material culture was exported from the USSR. And they still use it. The Soviet refrigerators that I grew up with, uh-huh. the Soviet cars, the Soviet washing machines. Imagine me sitting down, you know, this exotic island, sitting down with a bunch of, you know, Cubans my age, and we're all suddenly nostalgic for exactly the same foodstuffs. They say, oh, I remember, you know, the Bulgarian stuffed peppers. All the socialists, oh, I remember, you know, the Hungarian, you know, pickles with, like, you know, a picture of the globe on the cover. Oh, I remember the Soviet condensed milk. It was just really the bizarrest thing, and kind of very rewarding, because suddenly, you know, you see that you are kind of socialist brothers.
The shortages are obviously a big issue. How do the restaurants run when they don't know if they're going to be able to get salt or butter or onions? How do you run a restaurant like that?
That is a $1 million question. And what I've decided to do with this book, I've sat down with owners of, I think, 14 or 15 paladares, and I thought, like, not to get in their way, I will just let them tell the story. So the stories in the book are told in first person, in their voice, as told to me. And the biggest question is, yeah, how do you run a restaurant when there's a word perdido, going to be lost? So suddenly, you know, butter is perdido, salt is perdido. One restaurant told me, well, you know what, my biggest salvation is the chalkboard. And for me, the chalkboard is not a trendy, you know, bistro accessory. It's actually something, you know, when the service starts and I realize that, you know, two of the dishes I can't put in because something, you know, has gone missing, I just substitute it. The other woman, the Spanish woman who has a paladar, she said, well, you know, all this fashionable Spanish chefs from Spain and America come to my restaurant and they say, oh, and they talk about, you know, cocina de mercado, you know, market cuisine. She said, they don't realize we have nothing but the market cuisine. And market is completely quixotic. So it's supposedly a mango season, but, you know, the mangoes are not there. So you scramble, you know, to go to a hard currency store and get canned peaches instead of the mango puree that you wanted to put in, and you substitute it. I mean, people, the other difficulty is there is no wholesale market. And there's no legal export. So basically there's a suitcase trade. Mm. So everyone, if you need something like, you know, malt and salt, vanilla, spices, everyone brings it, you know, in their suitcases, and they're not supposed to. So they wouldn't even talk to me on the record about it. And then people improvise. It's literally like you don't know what's going to be on the menu. And all these people suddenly come knocking on your door with great fish.
Right.
So, for instance, there's one guy, you know, he runs these two places that are super hipster. They could be in Brooklyn. one is called O'Reilly 304, another El Del Frente. And he's never been abroad other than Cancun, which kind of blew his mind. But the menu looks completely trendy and up to date. I says, how do you know things? He said, well, my secret is I have a connection at the Havana airport, and he smuggles Spanish food magazines to me. For instance, somebody starts serving tataki, flash-seared tuna or beef. It's a Japanese preparation. So suddenly everyone is serving tataki. How do they know what tataki is? And they go, oh, well, there was some Japanese guy that came in and he showed us what a tataki was. So literally, you know, people, there's a lot of USB drives with cookbooks. That's how information travels. Believe it or not, avant-garde Spanish chefs like Ferran Adrià is a total guru. So everything has become, you know, mythologized and surrounded by legends. And this you actually see in front of your eyes, a cuisine is evolving. But of course, they serve classics as well, black beans, rice, that kind of stuff. But since paladares are expensive, really expensive for locals, they serve, you know, that kind of stuff to foreigners. But locals, you know, they want beef, they want lobster, they want stuff that, you know, you can't get, that is forbidden, actually.
Now, who goes to these paladares? Is it only tourists, or are there locals who can afford it?
There are a lot of expats, and a lot of the paladares are owned by expats, and their story is always the same. I kind of fell in love with Cuba. I fell in love with a girl or a guy. I stayed, and then I opened the paladar because there was no good places to eat. But there are enough, you know, there are enough Cubans who travel. You know, they bring business associates, a lot of people from Miami, a lot of their relatives that come. There's some really older, you know, popular ones, even the state-owned ones, like, you know, there's this famous roast chicken restaurant. So there's this huge reunited families, you know, relatives from Florida come and they take out their Cuban families there. But there are, some of them are completely full. You can't get in. You actually need a reservation.
And you can make a reservation just calling them up?
Yeah, if you can get online. if you're lucky enough to get internet, you can do that even.
Anya, thank you so much.
It's been a gas. Thank you so much.
Anya von Bremzen is the author of Paladares, Recipes from the Private Restaurants, Home Kitchens, and Streets of Cuba. Melissa Clark is the author of Dinner in an Instant, and Anya has a recipe on our website, splendidtable.org, inspired by Cuba's Chinese criollo cuisine. It's trout with black bean sauce. It's really, really simple and really, really delicious.